first time. All the others are okay.
Okay?
Yes.
I did say that when I told the president I was going to get married, he asked for her name and then wrote down on an envelope that he took out of his pocket. When we got through with our business and I stood up to leave, he said, "Have you got a few minutes, Leonard?" And I said, "Of course, Mr. President." And he said, "I want to write a note to Sharon." And so he left Fritz Mondale and me to talk and went over to his desk and wrote out in his own hand a very warm note to Sharon and put in an envelope with her name on it. Gave it to me, which I thought was very gracious.
Something I'm sure that you have kept.
Oh, yes. Sharon has. Then I went back to Peking, and I note from a letter that I sent that it says I went back in a much better frame of mind than I had come back from my visit in the fall of 1977 because of the understanding as to going forward. And when I...
Now, had you talked with the president about dates? We got that last time, right? So that we covered
yes,
this.
You the,
covered the sense of timing.
That after the election,
right.
And... we did not talk about January 1st, 79 at
right.
that point, but we did talk about not letting it slip down the calendar in 79 because of the possible presidential campaign impact.
Did you in that conversation also cover the subtle nuances that we knew awaited us? And there were two. First, whether the Chinese would have to explicitly renounce the use of force or simply acquiesce to our statement that we were confident there would be peaceful resolution. And secondly, whether we would need an explicit Chinese endorsement of our continued arms sales to Taiwan or simply that we could proceed with them simply disagreeing with our sales.
That was implicit because I had been advocating that, as you know, but there was not any extended discussion of those details, no.
That we left to the October meeting that you
right.
had with the president. That was what was crossed at that point. Okay.
And when I got back to China, I learned that Senator Jackson was on a visit to China, and he was coming back through Peking before going home. He was coming back by train from, I think he'd been up in the northeast, and then he was going directly from the train to the airport to leave. I think I may have mentioned that there were strained relations between myself and Scoop Jackson at that point, growing out of the 76 presidential campaign, when he felt that he was the most pro-labor candidate and that I should have supported him rather than Jimmy Carter. And he particularly felt that with regard to the Pennsylvania primary, which was sort of the end of the road as far as he was concerned. So I made it a point to go out to the airport to see him and to bid him goodbye. I was a little nervous about the kind of reception I'd get, but he gave me a very warm reception and renewed our old relationship, which was very important because he was strongly in favor of normalization between them. Between our two countries, and he assured me that he would go back to urge upon the president as speedy action as possible. And so that the future times when I was back home, I saw him on the old basis. I note too a meeting with the vice president of IBM that took place at that time. It had been my habit whenever I met with American technical groups, whether from the Electronics Industry Association or the machine tool builders or companies in high technology fields, to ask them how they found the professional competence of their Chinese counterparts. And invariably the answer had been, very good. When I asked this IBM vice president, he said, very poor. And I expressed surprise and told him that previous answers had all been to the contrary. He said, well, if you had asked me that same question after I'd been in Peking 10 days or 2 weeks, I'd have given you the same answer. Because the professional competence of those we meet with here in the capital is very good. But he said, I've been out in the factory in Shenyang, and the gap between the center and the locality is a difference of night and day. It isn't that they're not intelligent, they just don't have the training or the experience.
Leonard, your reference to technology reminds me that we did not return in our last session to the third of three questions I posed. During your February trip, you addressed the issue of normalization, you addressed the issue of Zbigniew's visit. Did you at any point, as you now are able to recall, get involved in the discussions of technology transfer to China?
I don't think so.
That was a hot issue already, I think, at the time, as to whether we should relax our export controls toward China and establish a what would be called a pro-China differential between the levels of technology that we monitored toward China and toward the Soviet Union. Do you recall when you began to be aware of that issue and send cables back expressing your views?
No, I don't. Can you jog my memory?
No, I don't. That's something that would have been something that would have fallen within Harry Thayer's domain and communications to you as to whether he was eliciting your views. We, by this point, Dr. Brzezinski and I, by this time, were already, as I say, had begun to organize the Frank press visit and began to push this issue.
Well, I was unaware, as I said before, of the press visit. And on that visit, certainly, there's no indication in my appointments of any discussions relative to that, and I have no memory of it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not even sure that we were ever asked for our views in that regard.
It was a very sensitive issue. At that point, in fact, Secretary Vance had laid down a law, laid down an order, that he did not even wish to have the issue discussed in the building. Maybe that's why you weren't consulted. That he did not wish
Probably.
The issue discussed and not raised in his presence.
I think I was aware of that now you mention it. That that sort of thing was off limits, but I have no memory of any cables on the question asking for our views.
That probably is the reason. Yeah, I've just jogged myself thinking why not the case.
And nothing very much happened in the period following my return. I was still, at this late date, engaged in courtesy calls on other ambassadors, because I think I mentioned I determined to cover everybody. I had been given the list of only those who were worthy of a mm-hmm. visit from the U.S. representative, but particularly made at the point with the African ambassadors because of the good efforts of the Carter administration to reshape African policy. So that was still going on at this late period. Then I show here that we had a VTR showing of Secretary of Defense Brown's Los Angeles speech, which we gave for some other ambassadors. Why would we be doing that? That speech, wasn't on technology, was it?
No, I think it was on overall Carter administration defense policy. And I think that it was the beginning of the commitment to a 3% buildup. That was it.
I see.
Yes, because that was such a crucial part of Biggs' presentation, actually, when he arrived. That's right, it was the 3% commitment. Let me ask you about your personal life at this time. Had you set the date already for your marriage with Sharon?
Well, the divorce I filed was in Michigan and was a no-fault, no-contest divorce. And while I was home, I had agreed on the property settlement so that although it was agreed, but it flew apart because I remember being in Hong Kong and Delhi. Trying to make frantic telephone calls to find out what was going on. And I had been a little upset when I was back home that my wife was insisting on dealing through attorneys. She did not want to deal with me directly. This was not because of any animus, though, but I think figures and such had never been her long suit. But by this time, I was very grateful because it was her attorneys who convinced her that the additional things she was seeking were beyond reason. And my concern, of course, was that if we did not have a property settlement, then the divorce would have to go to litigation on that question and drag things out. But that was finally settled. So we had an approximate date, going 60 days from the date of filing, which took us into mid-April.
But you announced then publicly that you would be married somewhat later than this period. Because I remember when we arrived in May for the Brzezinski visit, it was already known, but it was not yet a public matter in March, the time period we're now looking at.
All of the staff knew, because I think I may have mentioned that at the point, on the day that I filed for divorce, when I got back to my apartment, the Associated Press called me. And my first reaction was that, my gosh, I'd only just left the courthouse 2 hours before. Somebody must have called them or whatever. But when I asked, how did you know about it so quickly? They had learned about it from the White House, because somebody had told the press that I had told the president I was going to be married, and the president had given me a note to take to my my coming bride, and that her name was Sharon.
Uh-huh. So it was.
And so the AP wants to know what's her last name. And I said, I'm sorry, I won't give you that, because, see, at this point, too, Sharon was at a nurses' conference in Bangkok. And we had some difficulty with telephonic communication. And she had not yet let her mother and father know. And I said, I do not want them to read about this in the newspapers. I want them to hear about it from their daughter. Well, it was a little item on television and so on. Then the South China Morning Post ran the story with a headline, Secret Passion. And, in fact, I got back to China before she got back from Bangkok. And she did. Of course, at the nurses' conference, there were many of her old associates. And she didn't tell them. She was in Hong Kong on her way back when the South China Morning Post prints this story. And she was rooming with someone who was considered herself a good friend and was very upset because she hadn't been told about what was coming. Then the question arose after the property settlement was in hand, and of course it had to be sent by mail to me for signature, and until it was finally, with all the signatures on it, couldn't be counted as sure. And that took us into March. Then I had returned from home on Friday, the February 17, in Peking, and we told the staff immediately because there were these. Stories in the paper, which they certainly could interpret. And then Sharon had to make a very quick trip to the U.S. with on a medical evacuation. And she got back from that trip. She was only gone something like 72 hours. On Sunday, February the 26th. And we then had a press conference, the two of us, on Wednesday, March 1. Just to clear the matter up. And John Fraser, who was then in Peking for the Toronto Globe and Mail, towards the end of the he first said to Sharon, "Have you been married before?" And she said, "No," so there was no story there. And then towards the end of the press conference, Fraser said to me, "Have you ever had any inoculations since you've been in Peking, Mr. Ambassador?" And I thought, and I said, "Yes, I had a tetanus shot." "Oh, where did you get that?" I said, "I got it across town in the Chinese hospital, quarantine section." "You've never had any others? Have you had any here?" And I said, "Hasn't Miss Tui ever given you any?" "Oh, yes. She gave me a gamma globulin shot." "Oh," he says, "and that isn't in the arm, is it?" And I knew was coming, and I said no. And he filed a story which got widely printed about how this was the beginning of the romance. Some headlines were, Leonard gets the point, or play on Cupid's arrow, and so on, which, of course, was a cute story, but far from the fact. Then the question came to get ahead a bit, that how do we go about arranging for a wedding in China? Well, we go to the district office and you file a paper requesting it, and they had to have proof of the dissolution of my marriage. And the question came, well, what proofs would they require? Because if they wanted the actual court documents, then that would take up to 2 weeks. At least 2 weeks for them to be processed and mailed so that we could present them. We then asked if they would accept a cable from the State Department, from the official in the State Department, that they in fact had seen the court order, and that that was that. They said yes, they would. Then I finally get word on, I think it was April Tuesday or Wednesday, April 11th or 12th, that it's all set and my lawyer is going down to taking a plane to Washington with the document to show Harry there. And I got a little chuckle out of the fact that the telephone call wouldn't do. He had to actually go down so that the cable, in fact, would be truly honest that they had seen, and not simply been told about the document. And so we knew that that this was to come on the on Thursday, the 13th of April. We then had our consul, John Tassick, along with Miss Run, who was our Chinese interpreter, go to the district office. And it seemed that on Thursday and Friday, April 13th and 14th, they were their labor days. They were out doing manual labor. And so the office would not be open. And come back Monday. Well, I didn't want to wait till Monday. I didn't want to wait till Monday at this point. We make some calls and get hold of the district chief. And all right. But at this point, we did not yet have the cable. But he agreed that, on the assurance the cable was in fact coming, that he would go ahead. So they went back and made the arrangements for Friday, the 14th of April. And on the way over there, this was on the second, or maybe they made three trips, Miss Run says, I don't understand why they're in such a hurry. If they were Chinese, I could understand why they'd be in a hurry. But you Westerners do what you want to do anyway. But we were married at 4 o'clock in the district office, and that day we had scheduled we were hosting a bilateral lunch for the departing Yugoslav ambassador. I might say that whenever an ambassador was to leave, the custom was then to have an endless series of farewell banquets for him if he was at all well known or came from a prominent nation. And I got a little tired of so many invitations. And it happened first with the British ambassador, Ude, who's now going to be the governor, governor general in Hong Kong. And I talked to him and said, we'd love to have something. Could we do it on a bilateral basis? So that not simply he and Lady Ude, but a number of the key officials in the embassy would have a luncheon or a dinner. He said, that's just what I want. And I remember my secretary saying, we can't do that. That can't be done on a bilateral basis. So I said, as long as the British ambassador is agreeable, we'll do it. So that the Yugoslav luncheon was on a bilateral basis, in which we'd have seven or eight from their embassy, because it also
created working relationships.
Right, and a continuity, not simply... and they became very, very interesting. I remember we had a dinner for the departing Mexican ambassador, and it lasted till midnight, singing songs around the piano, and they were really very interesting and good affairs. After lunch, Mrs. Drulovich finally got up and said to her husband, the Yugoslav ambassador, "We have to get out of here. These people are going to be married because by this time it was 3 o'clock, and we were scheduled to be over there at 4:00. And the wedding is very brief. District chief himself was there, said our petition had been granted, and we were there, however, about half an hour, during which time the calligraphers were making out the marriage certificates. We each got one, a very big one, would have been about 10 by 14 inches, with tractors and things in the corner, and then we went back and had a few drinks at the embassy. But then at 5 o'clock, we had a reception for the China Chemical Fiber Study Group.
That's a good story.
Which was going off to the United States. And when people used to say, "Where did you spend your honeymoon?" I would point upstairs. Where our living quarters were. And then we had to on Saturday, the 22nd of April, we had a wedding dinner for all of the Yuslo families, the liaison office families, and Chinese officials. Wong Hai-rung came. She gave Sharon a lecture about not letting me interfere with her internal affairs, hold up her half of the sky, and that she had rights and so on, and Hao Deqing, and quite a few Chinese officials came. And then that ended about 8 o'clock, and then that night at 9:30 we had a party for just Yuslo, which we had dancing and quite a good time. So that it was quite an event. And I think I may have mentioned, well, I'm not sure I mentioned in these, but I'm not sure how much longer. I certainly would have stuck it out for the balance of that year. But if I'd been by myself, much as I would have wanted, I doubt if I would have wanted to continue as the ambassador, because being by oneself there is... it's pretty tough.
What in particular during this makes it tough for a bachelor.
Well, the social side, and the long periods when you're just alone, and you just have a feeling of, you know, I was used to living alone. I'd been living alone for, at that point, 16 years, so it wasn't simply living alone, but there was a feeling of loneliness there, whether it was psychological, I presume it was entirely, but such as one didn't have, at least I didn't have, back home.
Well,
in normal,
and you were also in
surroundings.
You were also in a place where you had no friends. I mean, of long-standing,
right,
intimate people who knew you, knew all of your moods, your background, your values.
That, plus, there's a protocol feeling in the State Department professional staff. You know, I used to say to at least the senior people, this Mr. Ambassador and getting up when I walk in and so on, this is, I'm just not used to that sort of thing. Well, with Stape, it got on a, after he came, it got on a first name basis, and with David Dean. But the other senior people, one or two finally, but after a long stretch, otherwise it's, it would be, if they dropped the Mr. Ambassador, it would be Mr. Woodcock. And, so that there was a limitation on any intimacy. Plus, same thing when you're president of the UAW. You can't be seen as being socially involved with one or two people because it upsets the relationship with the rest of the senior people. So that there are restraints that flow both ways.
So that really there was just not many people with whom you could become intimate.
That's true.
And in a very harsh environment, perhaps. I felt that on my trips, and one reason I particularly wanted Lois there this summer is that I felt that I could probably not even survive in total good humor for a 5-month stay in China.
Yeah.
And one of the problems is that one cannot confide in any of the Chinese. I mean, that's so that one has to find it within a Western community. And then the Western community is so prone to gossip. I can see that.
So that Sharon was in more ways than one a godsend. And, she did a really magnificent job as the ambassador's wife.
Absolutely. Every group with which I was associated felt that way. She had a remarkable gift of making people feel warm and welcome and at ease, and it was immediately noticeable.
And she particularly got along well with the Chinese. Of course, they already felt warmly towards her because, as the nurse, she had gone out of her way to minister to them. My driver, for example, who was a kind of a tough character, she had noticed he'd done something to his hand. This was before, long before, and insisted on taking care of it. And so that he was delighted. He was delighted when we got married. She'd go in the kitchen, and the cook would, Mr. Lee, who was an excellent cook, would welcome that. They would work together on Western dishes. He taught her some of the Chinese cooking arts. And that staff would knock themselves out when we'd have just a two-hour notice for a luncheon, they'd really work hard to put it on. And I remember some of the other ambassadors' wives saying, well, we have to give 3 days' notice when we want something done. And one ambassador down the street from us, I think they'd had 13 cooks in 15 months, or 2 years, rather. And just were never satisfied. Well, the Chinese, Mr. Dai, who was there when I first went there, and who was the number two waiter on the roster, they suddenly took him away. And at Christmas time, 1977, I discover at a party that he's been assigned to the Australian embassy. Because the Australian ambassador's wife said to me, "That terrible Mr. Dai, how could you put up with him? He's awful." I didn't think he was awful. I thought he was, oh, he's terrible, terrible. So that after we got married, and several months later, the Diplomatic Services Bureau sent word to Sharon, would we take Mr. Dai back? And she asked me about it. I said, sure. So he comes back, and lo and behold, he speaks quite a bit of English. He's been teaching himself. And so when she saw the Australian ambassador's wife a few days later, she said, oh, it's so good that you were teaching Mr. Dai English. She says, teach him English? He's too stupid to speak any English. He had never let on to them that he knew any English. Because this woman hated the Chinese, and they knew it, and they responded in kind. But Mr. Dai was came back, and all of the staff were really really very good, and that was mostly her doing.
You touch on a very long-standing problem of Westerners in East Asia and Hong Kong and Shanghai before 1949, and then I noticed it in Peking this summer that a lot of Westerners look down on their Chinese servants, and almost in a racist attitude. The Chinese are very sensitive to that problem, very, very sensitive. They react in a predictable fashion,
right.
But if one accords them any dignity, but I don't necessarily mean in a patronizing, but just a respect for their station, but still saying that there is a station in life, but respect for the station, I think that one is able to elicit considerably more.
When Sharon went back on this last trip, and she visited the embassy, of course, Mr. Dai, the same Mr. Dai. Not too long before, there'd been a big soccer game, part of the World Cup series, where China had played Kuwait. And Mr. Dai said, well, if you'd been here, we'd have had tickets to that game. Because Sharon always used to try and get tickets to movies or soccer games or whatever for them. And she said, I may not have been able to get those tickets. Well, he said, at least you would have tried. And when we left, Mr. Guo, the driver, who was this tough, sort of legendary in the embassy, he drove us out to the airport. And when we got to the airport, he takes our bags in, and then he comes. He was alone. The rest of the staff were coming out, but they weren't there at this point. He had tears running down his face. I was amazed. And just shook our hand and held it. and the whole staff.
Did you get to know the did you get to know the families of the staff as well?
Yes. Sharon's uncle and aunt came to visit us, and he was a professional photographer, school photographer. That is, he makes a living out of taking graduation pictures and so on. And he was talking to Mr. Wong, who was the English-speaking member of the staff. He taught himself English and did very well at it. He had talked to Mr. Wong about taking pictures of him and his family in the park. He had the idea, and he asked me would I talk to him to see if it would be possible. And I said, well, I doubt it very much, because there had been earlier times when we had made such passes and not been rebuffed, but it made clear that it would not be good for them to do it. But to my amazement, oh yes. And the upshot was that they all brought all their families on a Saturday afternoon when they were off duty, supposedly. Saturday afternoons they were supposed to have political discussions, and when I first went there they had meetings right on the property, but as 78 wore on, they just disappeared at noon, and as far as I know went home. But they all came and had session lasted about 3 hours, took individual pictures, group pictures, family pictures. And also, we sent the ambassador's car to get them. And there must have been 12, I think, got out of that old marathon checker. But it must have made quite a splash in the neighborhood. They went,
memorable.
I think, to three houses, I think, or three places to pick them up, because otherwise they'd have had to take two buses and spend well over an hour just getting there. But it was quite a while before those pictures came, and they were all in color. And, they were really delighted to get them. And Mrs. Lee, who was the senior cleaning lady, took our cat Peter, that we had debated bringing back to this country. But she and Peter had gotten along very well. When we offered to take Peter to our house, Sharon offered, she wouldn't agree to that. She did not want us to see her house. And she said she would take Peter on her bicycle. Well, she did finally agree that Peter would go in the car with his belongings. But we couldn't go. And then when Sharon went back and saw Mrs. Lee, she had pictures of the cat for Sharon, but again made it clear that she was sorry, but she did not want her to come to the house. And she lived very close to the Peking Hotel, in a compound there.
Without speaking of your immediate servants and people who worked in the in your mission home, did you feel that some of the servants there were looking at, reporting on you?
Well, when I went there, I sort of took that for granted, but there was certainly no, you had no feeling of that.